Most people know you as the guy who faked getting fired from Twitter.
There were just a bunch of cameras outside, a bunch of TV reporters waiting for something to happen. I just texted our friend group chat, come to my gym with a box. And it would be really funny if we just walk out with it. We don't prep any lines. We don't prep what to say. We just wing it. I see a lot of my founder friends get stuck in this analysis paralysis of trying to come up with the idea that is completely bulletproof, can never go wrong. The best way to get validation is to do something, and action produces information. If you're very far away from the code, you tend to propose ideas that are not feasible all the time. An example of this is like, what if we just add a button here? But then it turns out to add a button there, you have to go refactor this whole view in React and then like rewrite some of the like rendering and the padding and the margins.
The way you do your pricing packaging is super interesting. Specifically, the most expensive tier, you give your phone number.
It's a great way to talk to users. And it's a great way to filter out the feedback that you should prioritize. We actually hacked the ChatGPT plugin store to get our users. And within like a month of constantly shipping a ton of code every day, iterating, fixing bugs, we knew we had a better product. But then our main source of users was going to disappear overnight.
Welcome to The Peel, where we explore the world's greatest startup stories. I'm your host, Turner Novak, founder of Nan Capital, the venture capital firm, also known for its epic pranks. I'm excited for this conversation with my friend Rahul Sunwalker, founder and CEO of Julius. Julius is an AI data scientist, and we'll get into exactly what that means. Most of you probably know Rahul for his epic prank from 2 years ago. On the day Elon acquired Twitter, Rahul and his friend stood outside the office with cardboard boxes and convinced reporters that they, Rahul Ligma and Daniel Johnson, had just been fired and more layoffs were coming. The Ligma Johnson prank took over the internet and real life, and we start by going behind the scenes of one of my favorite pranks ever pulled. Rahul's also building a very cool startup, Julius. We talk through hackathons and why he moved to San Francisco, lessons from his first failed startups, winning over investors with speed of execution, why he gives his phone number to customers, professors using Julius to teach their class, why AI will soon write more code than humans, and what happens when you give an AI a computer. After listening, I think you'll agree Rahul will soon be known for much more than his epic prank. A quick shout out to Rune, Guillermo Roach, Mike Nope, Akshay Kotari, Terrence Rohan, Sandy Corey, and Ashay Sangvi for their help suggesting great topics for our discussion. This is an incredible conversation and one of the first ones Rahul's had going deep on what he's building at Julius. I think you'll learn a lot. Let's jump in after a quick word from Atio. There's a world where your CRM is powerful, easily configured, and deeply intuitive. Atio makes it a reality. Atio is a CRM built specifically for today's modern company. It's flexible, easily configures to your unique data structures, and works for any go-to-market motion, from self-serve to sales-led. It automatically enriches your contacts, syncs your email and calendar, lets you create powerful reports, and quickly build Zapier-style automations. The next era of companies deserves more than a one-size-fits-all CRM with outdated UX. Someone recently described Atio to me as the linear of CRMs, which if you're in the know, that is high praise. Join 11 Labs, Replicate, Modal, and more. Try Atio instantly at atio.com, that's A-T-T-I-O.com, or tap the link in the show notes and scale your company to the next level. Thank you, Atio. And now let's jump into today's episode. Rahul, how's it going? Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Turner, for having me.
So I think most people know you as the guy who faked getting fired from Twitter right after Elon took over. And maybe some people are not familiar with the story, but can you just kind of take us inside that day? Tell us what happened. I think that'd be fun to talk about first.
Totally. Well, I guess for context, I live in San Francisco. I hang out on Twitter quite a lot as a user. I've been on Twitter for a few years now. And of course, I've been a big Elon fanboy since forever. You know, he's doing really cool stuff with rockets and with cars. And in San Francisco, I happen to live walking distance from the Twitter headquarters, or what used to be the Twitter headquarters. And my gym is actually in the Twitter building. So every morning I wake up, I walk to the gym, I work out, and then I head to the office. I believe a year and a half ago, on my way to the gym, there were just a bunch of cameras outside. A bunch of TV reporters waiting for something to happen. And I just found that to be really hilarious that, you know, this was happening. And I walk in. I'm sure these reporters, they definitely saw me walk in onto the gym. I work out. And then towards the end of my workout, I just text our friend group chat saying, hey, it would be really cool if, you know, if you prank these guys, if we just walk out with a box and see if they put us on TV. And I first text my roommate. He's not down to come through with a box. I text my other friend, Daniel, who is, you know, that meme of like your unemployed friend at 1 p.m. on a Wednesday. He had that vibe back then. You know, he's just hanging out, having fun. So I text him on a Wednesday or a Friday to come to my gym with a box. And it would be really funny if we just walk out with it. And he shows up with two boxes. We walk out. And the cameras, they fall for it. You know, they ask us a bunch of questions. We don't prep any lines. We don't prep what to say. We just wing it. And I said, my name is Rahul Ligma. And he said his name is Daniel Johnson. And it just, out of coincidence, became, you know, Ligma Johnson.
Oh, you didn't plan that? I thought you guys planned that.
No, it was all coincidence. And so I get followed for the next few blocks as I'm walking home. And then they like eventually let go of us. I get back to my apartment and I realize that the thing blew up like literally 10 minutes after it happened.
Wow. Okay. That was fast.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I didn't expect it to blow up because I was just out there having fun with my friends. And I thought, you know, a few of my friends would find it funny, but it became really big within like the next 30 minutes or so. You know, my phone's blowing up. Somebody gave my phone number to the reporters. They're calling to ask me if I actually work at Twitter or I don't. I was going through YC back then and I walk into my office hours, literally an hour after the thing happened. And my partner asks me, hey, are you working at Twitter while you're doing the startup? And I said, no, I have to tell you, this is like not real. This is like a prank. I thought this would be funny if I did it and my friends would find it funny. Really, that was the whole reason, just have fun with my friends, right? And then it really blew up after Elon tweeted about it. And the day became really crazy.
At what point was that? Was this like 2, 3, 4 hours later or pretty quickly? Or
it was picking up within the first 30 minutes. But like 2 hours in, it went from just like Twitter to like actual, you know, TV news.
Like real life.
Yeah. Like Daily Mail in the UK. And, you know, I started getting recognized on the street. So I'm walking over to get lunch. I get recognized. I walk home in the evening. I get recognized. And it kind of blew up from there.
Yeah, I remember when it was all going down, because I think we were kind of just Twitter friends, basically. I don't think we'd ever met in person or even really talked before. Same with Daniel, too, that you were with. Like, I was kind of Twitter friends with him. I didn't actually know what he looked like, actually. And I remember when this whole thing was happening, I think I DM'd him. I was like, is this you? Are you this Daniel Johnson guy? And he's like, yeah, no one, like, it's not public yet. Like, there's no connection. So, like, please keep it quiet. I remember that. Yeah, I remember just, it was probably one of my top favorite just trolls ever. Just, I mean, it was like, it was so funny how big a guy, like, the videos, all the memes from it were great. Just took over the internet for that day.
Yeah. Thank you. We actually got a chance to meet Elon a few times after. And, you know, meeting him was super cool. He is super high energy in person, even more high energy in person than he is, you know, in his videos or on Twitter. And the story of how we met him was also really interesting. We just showed up to the office and we said, hey, can we meet Elon? And, you know, they made us wait like 20 minutes and then they took us upstairs and they said, all right, here's Elon. So, yeah, he's pretty cool.
What'd you guys talk about?
We talked about like 2 minutes about the prank and then the remaining 40 minutes about what's going on at Twitter. Back then, he was really concerned about how many lines of Scala code there is on Twitter, in the Twitter code base. And it was really cool as a founder to know that he has that level of detail and insight. in a company that he just bought like 2 days ago.
Oh, this was like 2 days. This is 2 days after the acquisition closed.
It was the thing happened on the day the acquisition closed, the morning of.
Okay. So these reporters were like ready for just a fire sale. I guess so. Like whatever. Yeah. Fascinating.
And, you know, he like knew that level of detail. So that was really, really cool.
Yeah, I remember the whole thing about it kind of became a meme of printing off the code, like show me how much code you've shipped or something, which if you just think printing off code, what a stupid exercise, but it does show a decent amount. Like, is it a big stack of paper? Is there one piece of paper? Like, it shows how big it is and also like what you've contributed too.
Yeah.
So, and then I think the thing I thought was like pretty cool was, we'll get into Julius, the company that you're kind of building, but you kind of used that whole event to just kind of like jumpstart the initial seeds of distribution for everything that you're doing now. Is that a fair way to think about it?
I think it definitely helped me meet a lot of really cool people that I got a chance to work with that give me good feedback, and definitely a platform where I can, you know, share my ideas.
So going kind of all the way back to when you first moved to the US, you were a teenager. How old were you?
I was 18.
And you came here for school?
Yeah.
I think what stands out to me just from understanding and learning your story, you were super determined and focused on accomplishing your goals that you had at such a young age. How did you know that you wanted to kind of get a job at a startup, work in tech, move to San Francisco? Was there a line of thinking that kind of solidified that for you early on?
Yeah, totally. Well, I watched The Social Network, and this was before I was old enough to even use Facebook legally.
Okay.
But I watched the movie, and just the idea of building something with code and giving it to millions and millions of people and have those people use it and be known for it is really cool. And that kind of took me down on this path of, you know, what is startups? How does one start a startup? How do you build a website? What is code? And I just like went down that rabbit hole throughout high school. And I found a way to get to the US by taking the SATs and the ACTs. And I took the SAT when my English comprehension skills weren't as good. So I got a 1260 on the SAT.
Is that good?
That's out of 1600. So that's not good.
Okay.
If you want to go to a good school. But I got an 800 on math and then 460 on critical reading. So math was pretty easy. Critical reading was pretty hard. Somebody on the internet told me I should do the ACT because it has science, it has, you know, grammar, which is still more logical. And I was able to get a much better score and find a school to basically give me a full tuition scholarship to move to the US.
And then I think even when you were in college, you were doing hackathons. I think you won at least one. That's what I saw.
Yeah.
Did you do a lot of hackathons?
I did. That's the only way I learned. So I found that in school, most of the learning was not super applicable to building cool things, right? You learn things that are in computer science, you might end up learning things that are completely outdated and you don't need to know them. But I basically found that everyone around me was not at the same level of ambition or ideas that I was at. So people just wanted to graduate and go work at State Farm for the next 20 years, or go work at, you know, Allstate or Raytheon. They weren't into building startups or building cool things, cool projects. So I started going to hackathons and attending hackathons on the weekends. And that's where I met people who were more like me, who wanted to build cool things, work at cool companies, start their own startup. And I got those people to refer me to the companies they had interned at, or refer me to startups where I could like apply, interview, show my skills, and get an internship.
And I think you did get, at least according to LinkedIn, you got an internship at Facebook. Was that the first kind of big one that you landed?
There's a couple that are no longer on my LinkedIn, just to keep it a little organized.
Keep it clean. Okay. Well, I think you were telling me before, you had a really, in my opinion, pretty smart strategy that you used to kind of outreach people. Can you talk through that?
Totally. So I believe freshman year of college, I cold emailed Ivan of Notion.
Who is that, just for people who don't know?
Yeah, Notion is this really cool productivity app that lets you, you know, take notes, create databases, share the notes with people that you work with or people you like. It's really popular among knowledge workers.
And you said he responded?
He responded. He said, hey, thanks for reaching out. Appreciate the gumption, you know, but you don't have the experience we're looking for. So I basically found smaller startups to give me an internship. And then eventually by junior year, I was scraping Hacker News for all their hiring posts from back in 2010 and getting all the emails from those hiring posts. And then mass emailing a bunch of companies and recruiters and founders asking for internships. And I found somebody to refer me to Facebook. I interned at Facebook doing misinformation stuff. So I was an engineer on the team that stops the spread of misinformation, which is kind of ironic because, you know, just a few years after that, I was on social media or like on national TV spreading misinformation. So
you dissected the playbook of how to do it.
Yeah, exactly. But I did Facebook, then I did an internship at Uber after that.
Nice. And then you graduated and then you moved to San Francisco like full time.
Exactly. I graduated a semester early. I put all my stuff in a car, drove cross country to San Francisco, moved into an apartment. And then 2 weeks after COVID happened and everything shut down. And that was a very interesting time because that period introduced me to Twitter. I was, you know, on Twitter, you know, replying to cool people, building cool things, cool founders that you read about in the news, and they will sometimes like your tweet and reply to you. And you can DM these people and people respond.
So this is like what you were already doing, but you just like unlocked this superpower of instead of having to scrape them from Hacker News, scrape the emails, you could just slide into their DMs.
Exactly. And it also compounds because, you know, the more you post, the more you show up in people's feeds and people think you're interesting and you have interesting ideas and they follow you back. And then there's more social proof and you sort of compound that over time.
Yeah, I remember that's kind of how we met. I don't remember the exact time, but just through that kind of got to know you. And then,
well, you were an early believer because we knew each other before the pop-off.
Yeah, before the pop-off.
So you have a great eye for like early talent, I guess.
That's why I'm a VC.
I love that.
Can't build anything, so that's why I'm not actually a founder.
You're in the early stage. You're the pre-seed.
Yeah, so then you've definitely benefited from using Twitter. Can you kind of explain, like, if somebody's never used Twitter or they're like on the fence of like, is that even worth it? Like, what is it? What does it do for you? Just really leaning into it and growing it and using it to your advantage. Like, can you just talk us through maybe the benefits and then and or how you do it? Like, if you were to do it again, how would you make a name for yourself on Twitter?
Totally. Well, I guess I can share what works for me and why I use Twitter. I think Twitter is a really great place to find a subgroup of people that you connect with, and they could be across the world building really cool things or doing the same thing as you. And an example of this is I watch football a lot. And
is this soccer, American football?
American, or? Yeah. I'm a big Cowboys
American, fan. No, American football. Okay. You're a Cowboys fan. Oh, man. I'm sorry.
Are you Lions or?
I mean, I just know it's hard to be a Cowboys fan.
It is. It's not easy. It builds character, though.
I saw this one amazing meme on Instagram. It was like, there's been more solar eclipses in the last 2 years than like Cowboys playoff wins or something.
No way.
It was something like that.
That doesn't surprise me. The last time the Cowboys won a Super Bowl, I wasn't even born.
Yeah. And that, so you use Twitter to follow football? Is that where you were going?
Well, so I basically, you know, on Twitter, you can see football fans, you know, and football is really big in America, but there's like these small subgroups of like fans in Canada, in Japan, who like also follow football and they like reply to these tweets. But it's sort of like a way for you to meet people who share the same interests as you and build that community and connect with those people. For me, it was partly football, but also partly startups and, you know, people doing cool stuff with startups and building cool things. So I basically use that to, you know, follow really good founders that I admired and thinkers and builders and reply to them, but also keep it lighthearted. You know, like you don't want to be super serious at all times. You always want to be having fun, because if you're like super serious at all the times, then somebody who is just having fun will beat you. Like, I think Turner, you're a great example of this, because you're in Michigan, I believe, and you're just like the funniest VC on all of Twitter, and you have your own fun now. Like, there's so many people out in Michigan or some areas of the world that are not tech centers, and they just keep lurking and kind of wish that they were part of the action. But then there's Turner, who is just out there connecting with people who are in San Francisco and connecting them on a level like your friend in San Francisco would. You know the jokes, you know the gotchas, the insights, like you're just out here sharing all that. So I was something similar, but I was already in San Francisco. It was just COVID lockdown.
And then what benefits has it brought you, just in terms of you started a company, I guess, around the same time after, like, what all have you gotten from being a presence on Twitter?
I've definitely met some of the smartest people I know today off of Twitter. I've also met most of the Julius team, either on Twitter, on Clubhouse, or at hackathons. In fact, that's the whole Julius team. I met some of them on Twitter. I met some of them, one of them on Clubhouse, and one of them at a hackathon. So yeah, I think it's a great way to meet people.
Wow, that's not an app or a word you hear much lately, Clubhouse.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was back in 2021 when we met.
Okay. Now, oh, you're using it in 2021 too.
I was one of the suckers who got in very late.
I mean, it was still, when did Elon? Elon did his big thing in, I think it was January of 2021, if I'm remembering. So that was actually probably like the peak Clubhouse was 2021.
Yeah, I think we met February.
Yeah, those are fun times. So then, and then I think you mentioned earlier, maybe it was while we were talking beforehand, you did YC, and this was before the big Twitter prank. What was the whole process with YC? Like, did you know what you were going to build? Were you like, I want to start a company? You were working at Uber beforehand. What was that whole process like of leaving, starting something, and then doing YC?
Yeah. So I basically spent all of COVID trying to meet cool people, either online, learn from their ideas, and build ideas of my own. So one of my first ideas was, you know, I was listening to a ton of podcasts, watching a ton of YouTube videos. And what I found was that an interesting part of watching podcasts on YouTube was you can actually scroll down to the comments and get interesting questions, talk to other people listening to the same podcast. People will post jokes, or like they will expand on certain things discussed in the podcast, and you can like reply to them. And there was this additional content after the podcast in the comments. And that was missing on the Apple Podcast app and the Spotify app, where there was no comment section. So my first idea was, can you build like a comment section for podcasts? And it didn't take off. I built it. It was called podcastcomments.com. It didn't take off. It didn't go anywhere. But regardless, it was like really fun to build it, because that's something I wanted and I wanted to use. And I learned a lot. Like, I learned for the first time how to make a mobile app. I had never made a mobile app before. So how to make a mobile app, how much it sucks to work with iOS, and it was very useful.
And you used it? And did other people use it?
Well, the thing is that only I used it.
Okay, so you were commenting.
Yeah. Usually, like, you want to, like, there's one thing I realized was that there's way more consumers than creators, right? For every one person who is creating content, there are like 20 or 50 other people who are just consuming. And that's true for most like social platforms, right? Twitter, there's like 1-to-20 ratio probably of people posting tweets to like just people lurking and reading tweets. Same with YouTube, maybe even more, like, you know, 1-to-1,000 perhaps.
Yeah, YouTube is tough, because I mean, Twitter is just, you can just It's a keyboard. You type it in. It takes 2 seconds. YouTube, it's like, you got to make a video. You got to edit a video, upload it. It make a thumbnail. Like, no one knows making the thumbnail on YouTube is like half of the process, basically.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, totally. I've tried to make some joyous like tutorials and I use Canva for it, but they're just nowhere as good as Mr. Beast thumbnails.
Yeah, I need to up my thumbnail game. I don't know, probably like a third of the people who listen to the podcast listen on YouTube. And I mean, my YouTube thumbnails suck. I gotta up my game. If you're listening to this and you're like, Turner, I agree your thumbnails suck and I think I can do a better job, let me know because I need help.
Totally.
One thing I thought was really interesting, I kind of talked to a couple people before this, got some feedback on good questions to ask you. So one of the people I talked to was Guillermo Roch, founder of Vercel. So he's a huge fan. I think he's actually one of your angel investors when you raised a little bit of angel money. He said that a big part of your pitch was the speed of execution. He just said you guys move really, really fast. And he thought that was really impressive. How do you show that in a pitch? Like, he said it was actually like integrated in your pitch was how quick you moved. And it kind of convinced him that he needed to back you.
So I guess I can maybe give a little bit of context about what I was building back when we pitched Guillermo. And this was right after I had quit Uber, 2022. And I honestly took way too long to quit because I was building these things on the side and sort of launching them and they weren't taking off. And my initial plan was, okay, I'm going to continue working at Uber on like machine learning stuff. And when I have something that's sort of taking off, I'm going to quit my job and go full time on it. And honestly, that didn't happen. So after about a year of just like nights and weekends, I quit because I just got tired of half-assing it. And my first idea after I quit was, you know how you book an Uber? You can see on your app where the car is. You can see where it's moving, what's the ETA, when it's going to pick you up, when it's going to drop you off. All of that doesn't exist for logistics. And there's thousands and thousands of trucks that are moving every day today in the US that are moving produce, moving goods, moving packages that the people, the brokers and shippers who book these trucks have no idea where they are. The only way they figure out is by picking up the phone and calling truck drivers and asking truck drivers, hey, are you going to make it at 4 p.m.? Or can I put you on the 8 p.m. slot? And this creates a ton of inefficiency. Imagine if you couldn't know where your Uber is on the Uber app. You know, that would be really hard.
You should call the driver every 5 minutes. Hey, are you close? Where are you?
Exactly. Or like, where are you picking me up? What street are you on? Like, that would just get so complicated. So the first idea was, well, you know, the government mandates that all these trucks have these things called ELDs. It mandates that.
It's like tracking devices, right?
Exactly. Tracking devices. So, and the idea was, hey, can we like take all that data, aggregate it, and make an experience as smooth as Uber and, you know, give it to shippers and brokers who book these trucks to let them see on a site where a truck is.
Seems like a cool idea.
It seemed like a cool idea in theory. We built that in a few weeks. We just, you know, hacked through it and got it working. And the way we did it was that there was this long tail of ELD providers. So what we would do is every time we would get a new truckload, we will figure out how to reverse engineer that ELD's API on the fly, because there's like hundreds of these ELD providers and we can't build all the API integrations up front. So the plan was, hey, like, let's start taking truckloads. And as we get new drivers and new hardware, we can like figure out the API for it.
I mean, don't you have to do that like instantly to make them show up on the map?
So luckily for trucks, they move over days. So, you know, if we have like 6 hour heads up, if a truck is moving from Nashville to Los Angeles or Long Beach.
So you'd have like 6 hours, like the course of the freight trip to build the integration.
Yeah. Well, the thing was that we had nothing else going on, right? It was like, it's not like we had thousands of loads. So we did that for like the first 10, 12 loads. And we sort of tried to keep scaling that up. But soon we realized was that people, like we were solving the right problem, the people really wanted it because we're giving them so much efficiency that solves scheduling, planning, delivery, all these different things. But what was really hard was to convince the truck drivers who were, you know, 60-year-old guys in like Kentucky to share their live location at all times. That became a real challenge. And we had to basically call, we had to beg them. We tried all different things to get these drivers to accept.
And so your customers were people that needed to track the freight. Those are the ones who were probably paying you, but the truck drivers needed to just participate in this.
Exactly. So for some context, you have the Amazons or the Walmarts of the world who own the truck and who are the shipper and who are the receiver, who are, they're the receivers too. So they own the truck, the driver is an employee or a contractor. And so in that case, the driver, they know where the truck is. But there's this whole other side of logistics where, for example, Flexport, right? They help you move freight across the ocean. The way they do it is they, you know, find a ship that's moving from point A to point B, get your load on that ship and bring it to you. So there's a lot of quarterbacking happening. And sometimes these trucks are moving loads for multiple shippers or to the same receiver, sometimes multiple receivers, but the same shipper, all kinds of complexity. And these drivers, they just do jobs, right? They pick up a job and then they move the load and then go to the next job. And it became a real challenge to convince these drivers to share their location with us. And we tried all sorts of workarounds. But to answer your original question, how did Guillermo know we were moving fast or shipping fast? Is I actually met him at an event in San Francisco. And everyone was just like hovering him, like asking him about Vercel. And we were using Vercel back then. I'm a huge fan of Vercel. You know, it just makes building front end, fast performant front end, so easy for someone like me who completely sucks at front end. So if Alex is watching this podcast right now, he knows how much I suck at front end. He's the one who builds most of the front end for Julius. He's our founding engineer. Well, so Guillermo, I met him at the event. I asked him for his contact information, and then I sent him a link of a live truckload moving on live trucks.
Okay.
Hey, you can follow this load going from point A to point B, and it's a real truck moving right now. And we built this whole thing in like 6 weeks or 7 weeks. And then we told him how much sales we have closed, and he was super impressed, and he supported us.
That's amazing. Why trucking? Like, it's kind of random. And like, was it just one of many ideas that you worked on and then moving on from it when it didn't quite work? Or,
you know, I left Uber and I knew how, you know, to give you a smooth Uber ride, there's so much that happens in the background, from like dispatching to pricing to taxes, like how you collect taxes on an Uber ride. Like, all that is really complex. But to the experience of the driver and the rider is really seamless. And I wish that I was kind of looking to apply that to a space that didn't have that. And I looked at trucking and it seemed like it didn't have any of that, which I think I was right about. But I vastly underestimated how hard it would be to convince truck drivers to share their location.
Yeah. So maybe I'm trying to think of like what would be a good lesson there for other founders. It's just you got to think through like people actually use the product, or will all the touch points, does it solve problems for them? Is it urgent enough?
I think the incentives need to be aligned for everyone, right? Because we had so many different pieces. We had to convince, in many of these loads, there were brokers who would coordinate the load between a driver and a truck and a shipper. And then there was a driver who had very little incentive to share his location because they have driven a truck for 40 years a certain way. And they have a certain pattern where they like stop at a Walmart the night before and sleep overnight. Or so we didn't consider all the pieces. It was also, I think it was also like something we needed to do to know. Like, it would have been really hard if I think of 2022 me to come up with all the like possible ways this could go wrong and then plan for that ahead of time, as opposed to just like doing it, spending, you know, 6 months of my time trying to make it work. And then eventually, you know, moving on to something else.
So sometimes it helps to just do the wrong thing, just to know why it's wrong or why it won't work.
I think I see a lot of my founder friends get stuck in this analysis paralysis of trying to come up with the idea that is completely bulletproof, can never go wrong. The execution plan is completely de-risked. The team is the right team to build what you're trying to build. And there's a lot of money that you can raise on that idea. Like you want all of that. But to be honest, like there's no idea like that. You know, the best way to get validation is to do something. And always, you know, action produces information and take the information and then act on it.
Yeah, I think the only thing you can really control as an early stage founder is just yourself, how quick you move, how fast you execute on things. To the point earlier, it's always good to see someone outside is like, wow, these guys are moving super fast. I mean, I've invested in, 70, 80 startups. Literally not a single one has gone exactly how anyone thought it would. So it's like, it happens. Like it's not an easy thing. Sometimes it happens faster, sometimes it happens slower. It's never what you thought. Half the time it's like totally different business, or maybe it's like similar customer, but you solve their problem in an entirely different way and your business model, your product looks different. So to that point, how did you go from software to track trucking trucks to you're building Julius? It's like an AI native data analysis tool. I mean, I'll let you kind of explain it, but what was that journey like of going from point A to point B? Or maybe it was point C and D and E and many different points.
Yeah, totally. I guess I will first give a 2-sentence description of what Julius is so that, you know, people can orient their mind around what it does. And then I'll walk you guys through the path on how we got there. But today, Julius is an AI data scientist that helps you analyze spreadsheets. So if you have a spreadsheet, you can feed it to Julius and have the AI analyze it for you, give you insights, create data visualizations, all with just simple English.
So then how do you take, what's the benefit then of like if I would normally be a Tableau user or use spreadsheets in Excel, like what gets me excited when I hear or use Julius? I'm like, holy shit, this is cool. Like what's usually the thing?
Well, if you're a Tableau or Excel user, you can do all the things you can do in Tableau or Excel just much faster and with just simple English commands. So instead of grappling your way in Excel or Tableau for an hour, you can do it in Julius within 5 or 10 minutes in just plain English. But then there's way more people out there who don't know Tableau or Excel or Python or Jupyter Notebooks. They can bring their spreadsheets and have the AI give them insights about that spreadsheet. So some of our users are people who work heavily with spreadsheets and Excel files, but lack the technical expertise to dive into that data and get the insights out of it. And they use Julius as their data scientist in their pocket to do that.
So what's kind of a prime example of use case? Like what might my role be and what might I be uploading and getting it out of it and using it for, just to like get people in the mindset of how it kind of works?
So there's a few different use cases for Julius. You know, the most popular ones are finance. So if you have financial data in a bunch of Excel files, you can upload all of those to Julius and the AI will crunch the numbers, give you the insights you're looking for, create the data visualizations within minutes. If you work in academia or research, you can upload massive data sets that you've collected about your scientific experiments and the AI will run regression, ANOVA, all these different kinds of complex analysis that you normally would need a data scientist for. And the AI will just do all of that for you within minutes. Lastly, if you work in like sales and marketing, you might have ad campaign data or marketing campaign data. You can use Julius to do complicated things like clustering and cohort analysis and campaign performance. All of this without needing to know the technical details of how to implement that or the details of how to learn those techniques. You can just have the AI act as your data scientist and do all that for you.
What's your favorite use case or favorite like user persona that you've come across that someone's used it for?
Well, I'll give you 2. So one of our users, he is the COO of a hot tub company in Middle America.
You said hot tub company?
Hot tub company, yeah.
Okay.
And he uses Julius to analyze and like forecast his sales. And I got on a call with him one day, and he literally has a single Google sheet with each tab for each week's sales going back like almost a decade. It's crazy. And he just feeds that into Julius and has the AI do forecasting. And or some of the interesting things was that it was out of the box able to pick up things like seasonality, right? People don't buy hot tubs in the summer, but they buy hot tubs late in the fall.
Yeah, that's true.
It was able to pick up that seasonality just from that decade-old data, and it blew his mind. So this was really cool because we thought, you know, there will be people in San Francisco who will use it, but then there's these users who found Julius and they really love Julius. But there's also a group of academics who have really embraced Julius. And, you know, generally, academics have been somewhat anti-AI because it tends to like seem like cheating in a classroom and a homework. But we have academics who found Julius on the internet, and they're using Julius to teach a whole class. There's a professor at Harvard Business School who's teaching Intro to Data Science to his business school students using Julius. And all these people will want to know the useful things you can do with data science, but they lack the expertise to do that. And they're learning all of that with Julius. There's a professor at Rice University who is teaching AI financial analysis using Julius. And I was able to fly to Rice, be in the class, and just watch a classroom full of people learn Julius and financial analysis.
So his class is he like teaches the class and they use the product throughout like the course to like complete assignments and things?
Exactly. The assignments. So they up until this semester, he used Excel. And starting this semester, he's been using Julius. And, you know, if you look at his slides, it's like, ask Julius to load this file and then ask Julius to do forecasting or ask Julius to do regression. And he has like some prompting tips, but pretty much his whole slides are how to use Julius to do the things that he's teaching.
Yeah, because I guess when I think about how you'd usually do a class like that, you probably have to learn this, you know, data analysis software. I can't even remember the one we had to use once in one of my finance classes. I think it was called MATLAB.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I don't even think I did the assignment. Like, I don't even think I did the project because I didn't feel like learning the software. I mean, it was my last semester. I was kind of already graduated, but
I love that.
We're going to cut this part. I'm just kidding. We're not cutting that. it brings up an interesting question. Like I think you mentioned you have about 600,000 people that use it, correct?
Yeah.
How'd you get people to start using this thing?
Totally. Well, so we went through a few different, you know, iterations of taking the data aggregation thing that we were building into Julius, you know, a bunch of learnings along the way. For our next thing, you know, that we tried, and one of the things that I was really passionate about was just AI, because I was spending my nights and weekends tinkering with language models, trying to get them to do interesting things, and trying to find ways on how we can incorporate that into what we're building. So our first idea was, can we like take massive data sets and make it really easy to query those with SQL using just English? So you ask in English what you want out of the data, and the AI will write SQL for you and give you the insights. Soon when we build that, we realized that these models are not as good at SQL as they are at Python. Python is just like a way more powerful language with an ecosystem of modules that let you do amazing things like data visualizations, machine learning, regression, statistical analysis, all that out of the box. And we sort of found our way into Julius about 38 weeks ago. I actually count the number of weeks since we launched Julius. So we are 38 weeks into Julius after, you know, multiple tries trying to build something people want. And we built Julius, launched it 38 weeks ago, and since then crossed over 500,000 users. And how we got those users? Well, initially we were, you know, launching on social media, trying to get people to use what we were building.
Yep. You had probably 20,000 followers or something. I don't know. Maybe I should have looked, but you had like a little bit of a base to work with.
I did, yes. But one thing interesting I learned about PMF is that PMF is as much about the product or as much about the market as it is about the product. Like it's PMF. It's not just like product fit. You have to find a product that meets a market. And, you know, what we found was that the users, the market that really wanted Julius was not on Twitter back then.
Really?
We actually hacked the ChatGPT plugin store to get our users. So we basically made a plugin on the ChatGPT plugin store that was called AI Data Analyst or something, or Chat with Excel, I believe. And we built and we launched that. And for the first week or 2 weeks, we saw that people were using it. It was pretty clear from the first or second day. But for the first 2 weeks, we realized that people were actually using it. And then we realized that people are trying to pay for it because we added like a Stripe integration. But it took us like a week to realize that because we weren't getting the payments. Turns out the API keys that we were using were dev API keys, not production API keys. So people were trying to pay us and we just weren't getting the payment, which was really funny. But in the ChatGPT plugin store, we found this like initial group of highly intentful users who knew how to work with AI products, who understood prompting, who in that moment had a need, which was to analyze data. And they were looking up on the plugin store, how to analyze data, or like, how do I work with a spreadsheet? So we had a plugin for that. And then pretty soon we realized that the more plugins we have, the more users we get. So we took the same plugin and just made over a dozen plugins that did the exact same thing. We just called it a different thing.
Okay.
It was a plugin called Data Interpreter, which would rank higher than Code Interpreter on the plugin store. So if you tried to look up Code Interpreter on the plugin store, the Julius plugin would show up first. And that got us about the first like 10 to 20,000 users until OpenAI said, all right, guys, you're being a little too sneaky. Like no more playing with the plugin store.
Yeah, did you have like the most plugins like of any company? You had like 10 plus plugins?
I think so. So, you know, that was like a scary point in a way that we realized that our top source of users was going to disappear overnight.
Yeah. So was it like Julius was a separate thing? You had your plugins that lived in ChatGPT, like were those completely separate products?
So the plugin is how users discover Julius. So when you get the plugin, you sign up on Julius. So the plugin would trigger you to go to Julius, make an account, and then upload your files to Julius. And then, in fact, most users would just stay on Julius. And they would, because we had a better interface, we had built out the features that users needed to work with spreadsheets and actually do really convoluted analysis with spreadsheets. So some of them would still use us via the plugin, but many users would just stay on Julius because the plugin sent them there.
Yeah, I can see why that wouldn't be the greatest thing. I wouldn't be happy about that if I was ChatGPT.
I guess so. Yeah. You know, I'm really grateful for OpenAI for making really great models that we use, and they're doing amazing work and we're grateful for them. But I totally see where they're coming from. But, you know, a couple of months in, that was we were, you know, iterating because we had this strong influx of users that were actually using what we were building, because the things we built before, users would use them on the first day and then not come back.
Oh, so this was when you were doing Julius, but you weren't on the plugin store yet.
This was before we built Julius. There were a couple smaller things we built with SQL. And, you know, people would play with it for a day and then just not come back the next day.
So there's just no retention.
Yeah, retention was zero. But, you know, the retention, there was at least some retention with Julius early on. And more than we had ever seen before. So it felt like the greatest dopamine hit ever.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. People want what you're building or what you're selling. Like, that's pretty cool. So that was really the first time it kind of started to work.
Yeah, exactly. And then we just talked to these users. We like tried to get as many users as we can on a Zoom call and just ask them what they're trying to do and how can we build a better product for them and just figure out from there. And within like a month of constantly shipping a ton of code every day, iterating, fixing bugs, we knew we had a better product, but then our main source of users was going to disappear overnight. And this was about a month or two into the life of Julius, about 8 or 9 weeks in. And I think we had 10,000 users back then. And then we had to just sort of figure out how to work with the users we have, and then figure out, you know, how do we do marketing, like re-engaging these users, sending them emails, getting the word of mouth going. And then, you know, eventually like building connection between the users and our social media, and like talking about Julius and doing launches and getting more users from the launches. And just every week we like launch a new feature, which first of all shows the user that this is a live product. We're constantly building new things and adding them to the product. And second of all, it reminds them that Julius exists and they should go use it. So it helped us get that like initial like source of users. And then we worked our way from there to now over 500,000 users.
That's amazing. So you went from 10K to 500,000. You kind of like skipped over this like I was no big deal. What were some of like the monumental moments between those two times? Like any big feature or product launches or a marketing experience or experiments, like anything that really stands out as being like pretty big moment in that kind of journey?
When ChatGPT launched a GPT store, we tried the same strategy as plugins. It just didn't fit the same like format. So we didn't get as many users from the plugin store or from the GPT store as we did from the plugin store. But we basically kept trying a bunch of things. And I don't think it was, one thing about startups is that it's never like this. Like you don't go from like 10 to 500 like this. It's more like this and then a little bit of this and then a little bit of this. If you like zoom out 38 weeks, it looks like this. From week to week, it's a little different. A big, big part of it was talking to users and figuring out what they are trying to do and building a superior product experience for them and leveraging all the best models that are out there to do useful things. So we haven't invested in marketing yet a lot, but that's the goal. And, you know, hopefully that's how we go from 500,000 to 5 million.
Yeah. That's fair. So one thing I think you've done a really good job at, not spending on marketing, you've been really capital efficient. What's been kind of the secret to that? I mean, you have a super small team, a ton of people using it.
I think, you know, very little marketing spend. Really, the only spend is like salaries. Today, we are 4 full-time people, and including me. And we all write code every day, even if we are, you know, talking to users or, you know, doing something that is not code-related, try to get a commit in. So that is very efficient. It helps everyone get a better sense of what's feasible in the product today and what could be feasible in the future. If you're very far away from the code, you tend to propose ideas that are not feasible all the time. Or you tend to think of things in a very wishy-washy way. Is an example, this is like, what if we just add a button here? But then it turns out to add a button there, you have to go refactor this whole view in React and then like rewrite some of the like rendering and the padding and the margins or whatever. It's not easy as it looks, but it also helps the velocity going. It helps the velocity of the product. So we are pretty capital efficient in a way that we're really small, 4 full-time. All of us are in a room all day writing code and talking to users. And the second thing is we let the users fund us and fund our innovation by paying for the product. So we have a limited free tier where users can come in and try Julius, get insights out of it. And if they find it useful, we ask them to pay us so that we can use the funds to build a better product for them.
So it's free to use. There's no official paywall, but you kind of ask them to upgrade. Can you explain that? How does that work?
Yeah. Well, you get a certain amount of free usage every month. So if you're a very casual user, that's good enough for you. But if you're a power user, we paywall after a certain amount of usage and we ask you to pay. And when you pay, like we're able to use those funds to, you know, build a better product for you.
Yeah. And I think one thing, one of your investors, Sandy Corey, told me to ask about this. The way you do your pricing packaging is super interesting, specifically the most expensive tier, you give your phone number. You're just like, call me, text me. Why did you do that?
It's a great way to talk to users. And it's a great way to filter out the feedback that you should prioritize, right? You can look at any product today and give a ton of unsolicited feedback, right? If the PM of Slack reached out to me and asked me, hey, what's your feedback? And I could just fire off 50 pieces of feedback that I think would be cool to have, but maybe other users don't want it. So talking to users is really important. And then being able to prioritize the feedback you get from users is really important. So even today, users text me, call me all the time. It's a very candid way to share feedback with me that I can, take it back to the team. You can text me at 10 p.m. on a Friday. And if I'm looking at my phone at that moment, I will reply to you. And my replies would be less formal. Like it wouldn't be, hello, thank you for reaching out. It would be, hey, Jake, let me see what I can do here. Or let me use this limit for you. Or I think you should try this prompt to get it to work. It's very casual and turns out that the users like it. It removes the barrier of formality to reach out to you. They get to talk to the CEO, asking questions. Many times users just reach out and tell us, the cool things that they're doing with Julius. Like they just pay the highest tier plan to just tell me the cool things that they're doing. So an example of this is there's a professor who teaches an undergrad class with Julius. His whole class uses Julius. And this spring semester, he did an open book test. And not only were the students allowed to, look at the books, they were allowed to use Julius during the test to answer the questions.
Wow, that's a bold use of AI in the classroom right there.
He is really bold. Yeah. And he texted us that experience and shared all of that. Not just open book, it's open Julius.
Yeah, that's awesome. We had a couple, I definitely had classes like that where it was usually the capstone highest level class in a track or whatever, like my capstone finance class. The teacher was like, you can use your books, you can use your notes. I'll give you all the questions ahead of time. You can cheat however you want. You can use whatever method and come to the test and take the test. And I mean, it's kind of like how the real world is, right? You're not going to show up at work and be like, okay, you can't use the internet to code this. No, it's you're good. Why would you not use tools?
Yeah, 100%.
So Mike Knoop, he's one of the founders of Zapier. He said, you guys will be brainstorming and then 12 hours later, you'll come back with a demo of the feature or the product. So do you think the way you've kind of structured the teams and the way you've built the code base, does that allow you to have a certain product velocity and then philosophy on building products?
Yeah, I think our philosophy is primarily two things. One is good ideas can come from anywhere. And if there's a good idea, we should implement it and give it a try. Not all good ideas work, but there's a good chance a good idea might work and make a real big difference. And we should give it a try as quickly as possible. One of the things that sucks is having an idea backlog. You always have this backlog of ideas that you are really passionate about and you're waiting to try them and you never really end up trying them. That is not cool. You should try to, get those ideas out of the door as soon as possible in the most minimal way possible. The second thing is AI is moving really fast. There's new advancements being made every month. And if you're building these models or building with these models, you need to have the mind of a child that's always, tinkering with things and playing with things and trying to understand how things work and trying to integrate all of that into your product, into the things that your users see in really useful ways. Because if you don't, then there's other people out there who will do that. So with AI, I think you need that mindset to constantly play with the models, experiment with ideas, and integrate with those things as quickly as you can. An example of this is, OpenAI just released a GPT-4 Turbo 0409. And
it was going to be outdated by the time this is published.
That's how fast AI is moving right now. But they released that 2 days ago. And, within an hour, we had that integrated because we just play with models so much, swapping out models, testing them all the time in our free time, that we know when there's a new model, we are how to make it work, how to test if it actually breaks things or not. That mindset is already there. So with Mike's example, he proposed an idea, which I can't share on the podcast, but it related using models in an interesting way to kind of like growth hack Julius to like 5 million users from where we are today. And to me, that seemed like a really interesting idea. Like it was a very valid idea. And Mike is super sharp. He's awesome. He's built a great company. So there was no reason to like drop everything I'm doing and drop everything that we are doing and go build that idea. And we basically did that. And in 12 hours, we had a prototype. And then over the weekend, we started getting feedback on the idea. So it was kind of like a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, and talk about using marketing ideas, using models. I mean, Zapier had like the ultimate automated, I mean, AI wasn't really a thing back 10 years ago, but they had the ultimate automated marketing strategy. Basically, like they just built a bunch of different features and like example use cases of the product, and people would Google for it and they just find the product and start using it. I mean, it's beautiful, their go to market.
It's so amazing. Yeah, I think both Zapier and Notion, incredibly capital efficient, bottoms up, loved by the community, great products, great founders.
Yeah, and I think you seem to do a really good job of kind of elevating your community. It's kind of like an overused word, but I just see sometimes you'll tweet something like Julia seen in the wild at like the, you know, XYZ newsletter, and you like give your customers and your users a shout out. Like, is that intentional? Like, does that help, you think?
A big part of it is morale. When you build something, by default, nobody cares. Even if you're probably Elon Musk. Maybe for Elon, people will care.
People also just shit on anything he does also. So
that's true.
Everyone has haters.
Everyone has haters. Yeah. Every single product has haters. You know, iPhone has haters and Tesla has haters. And there's not a single great product that doesn't have haters. Like Vercel, Guillermo is a company he has. I'm a big fan of it. I'm a user. I was a user before he funded us. But every great product has haters. Even OpenAI has haters. What's even worse than having haters is nobody caring. Nobody cares whether you succeed or fail. And that really sucks. You know, that was true for the podcast comments.com that I built. Is I built this thing and I really wanted to have a comment section on each podcast episode that I listened to. I could like read the comments, but nobody cares about the thing that I care about. And that really sucks. So a big part of it in like building startups and, you know, you keep going even when things aren't working out as you expected, with, you know, like all the ideas that didn't work out before Julius, was that people didn't care. And so today when people care, it feels so good. It feels, from a morale standpoint, it feels great. Like, well, we are actually building something that people want to use and they care about it enough that they will write about it or share their experience on social media about it. And it feels great. So I love elevating those people.
Yeah, it's good to just bask in it, because you probably have days where they just suck. Things do not go as planned. Your growth hack, your ChatGPT plugin gets banned or whatever. And like, you're like, man, are we done? Is it all over?
Yeah. All the like graphs go down after that.
In terms of just kind of like the future of AI, it's probably like the stereotypical tech bro podcast topic right now, but you're actually building something and like, it, you know, you're in it. So how do you just think about that? Like just the next 10 years, like if I'm someone who maybe I don't really understand AI, or I'm like afraid of it, or like I don't fully grasp it, like just help me think through like over the next 10 years.
Totally. So our vision with Julius is that very soon AIs will write more code than human beings do. In fact, Jensen talked about this in his GTC keynote. He predicted that AIs will be writing all of our code, not just some of it or more of it. All of our code will be written by AIs. And that when that future happens, it's going to allow people to do really powerful and useful things that they previously couldn't. Because if you think about it, like code is so powerful. You can make not just websites with it. You can do really deep data science with it. You can make apps with it. You can make software with it. You can solve problems. You can even use code to control a computer or a hardware device. All of these things are possible with code. It's like the most powerful tool built by humans yet. And AIs will soon be able to work with that tool in really useful ways that previously you had to be an expert in, right? You had to be an expert software engineer to make an app or make a website or make a really convoluted piece of software. So when that future happens, you know, people are going to be doing really useful and meaningful things. And we are building that future with Julius. We think today these models are good at writing code for data science and data analysis. But as the models get better, we will allow people to do, you know, really more powerful things like make a website, make an app, make software. In fact, the real powerful use cases of Julius aren't even being conceived of right now. Because, you know, when you look at a model 4 years ago, people thought, I guess I can use this to write copy for my website.
Yep. That was kind of the official first big use case.
Right. Or Pinata Farms, you know, like three years ago, they were taking Will Smith and making him like do cool things or sing a song or lip sync with a song. But now they're able to do way more cool things. So as the models improve, more and more useful things will become possible. And just 4 years ago, people were conceiving of, you know, copywriting as a main use case or SEO writing. And today it's like, oh, I can get an AI to do regression for me, or I can get an AI to plot millions of rows of data for me. And soon there will be more and more use cases. And Julius, our hope is that we build the interface and the tool to allow these models to do really useful things with code.
So then this is a question from our mutual friend, Rune, who you kind of mentioned this earlier, but he said, what happens when you give an AI a computer?
Totally. So that's pretty much what's happening with Julius today. So, you know, on the surface, people see this AI that works as their data scientist, and it can, you know, give them data insights, create data visualizations for them. But really, what we're building under the hood, behind that interface, is we're taking the best models in the world and giving them access to a computer where they can actually write code and do all the things you ask it to do. So if you give it a spreadsheet and you say, okay, can you find me my 10 highest paying customers from 4 years ago? It will write code to do that. It will spin up, you know, a code environment. Will write that code, look at the file, deconstruct it, look at the output of the code, and get you that answer. So that's how basically Julius works today, is we're giving these AIs their own computer. Soon that computer will have a browser. Today it just has the ability to like write code. Soon it will have a browser where it can like look up documentation on the internet. So when you say, hey, can you, I have this hardware out there in the field, and you can connect to this with this API, the AI will make a network request from the computer that we give it and manipulate that hardware. Or you tell it, hey, can you go to Shopify and get me all the reviews of my competitor and put that in a spreadsheet and like give me the main insights out of the review. It will spin up a browser, scrape Shopify, get you those reviews, and then give you that insights all with the computer and the code.
So it kind of takes... like for some of these examples, like your interface previously used to be a spreadsheet, or your interface used to be however you, or like the interface was like literally the, whatever the interface of that like hardware device was. What the future of AI, artificial intelligence, it kind of creates new interfaces where the computer can kind of talk to other pieces of the computer. And then the interface kind of changes from just simply being graphical to kind of being text space, and then text can also change into images or make a video or make a different type of spreadsheet or something. Like, is that kind of a fair way? It's like this whole new interface that like has a bunch of different things you can do with it.
Sort of, yeah. Like you basically have an AI or a bunch of AI models that are using a computer to do the things that you ask it to do. So Guillermo recently tweeted about Julius because he was trying to upload a video to Twitter. And it was for the most recent launch they did with Vercel. And that video needed to be a certain dimension. And he couldn't find a tool online to resize the video. he could have downloaded Adobe Premiere Pro or one of those like hardcore video editing softwares, or he just uploaded it to Julius instead and said, hey, can you make this video this aspect ratio? And Julius just did it. It imported FFmpeg, which is a Python module to like work with videos. It wrote a code script and resized the video for Guillermo. And he tweeted about it and got like thousands of likes or views. And that was the power of, you know, giving these models a computer to do these things.
Yeah, because if you think about it, when you're in Adobe Premiere or whatever product and you're changing the dimensions, like it's just you need to access like a certain interface that allows you to then change like what's in the code. Like it's just zeros and ones. Ultimately, what everything that we see that's electronic is all just zeros and ones.
Yeah, totally.
So it kind of like unlocks new interfaces, shortcuts, ways for computers to talk to each other, data to talk to each other, ways for information to flow, new interfaces, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So then what do you think happens? I mean, there's so many AI companies right now. It would probably take us like a full podcast episode to just list every AI company. So like, what do you think happens to all of them just over the next couple years? I believe this was a question from Ashay Sanghvi at Haystack. One of his questions was like, what happens long term with all these AI companies?
Totally. I think the future is kind of hard to predict. I have my own sort of takes on it. But as long as you're building something that is useful to people and people resonate with and really like using, I think these companies are going to end up in a really good spot. For companies that are not focusing on that and they are simply trying to do something with AI because it's hot, are possibly going to have some kind of trouble. So an example is Notion, right? Notion is for many people almost indistinguishable from Google Doc. Like it's literally a Google Doc. Like why do I need Notion? But then there's this whole other side of people or a community of users that live and die by Notion. Everything to them is a Notion doc or a Notion template. So if you can find those for you, people who love what you're building and people who can do useful things with what you're building, I think these companies are going to end up fine.
So will OpenAI kill every AI startup, or because that's kind of the meme that some people think?
I've actually thought about this quite a lot. And I love reading like early tech history. And if there's one lesson you can draw from, you know, early tech history, it's that the future is really hard to predict. You just have to like ride the tiger and see where you end up. In terms of OpenAI is like really friendly with startups. You know, we work with OpenAI, we work with Anthropic and other model providers. OpenAI is really friendly. A lot of my friends work there, and what they're building is really useful. If you can find useful things to do with what they're building, I think that's worth a lot more focus and attention than worrying about whether OpenAI will kill your startup. Because there's a lot of additional work that needs to be done to take these models and to make them useful in a friendly way, to make their outputs intuitive to users, and to leverage these models to their full potential. I'll give you an example. So today, over 200,000 images get uploaded to Julius every month. And when an image gets uploaded, because people, you know, take photos of their computer to like analyze some data, people want to take photos of math and solve math using Julius. But when they upload an image, we actually pass it through multiple models from multiple model providers to extract out the most information as we can. Oftentimes, we do that in a bunch of steps. So we use, for example, Claude's Haiku is a really fast model that gives you, that will, within milliseconds, will give you a very brief abstract of what's in the image. And then you can take that output and put it in a different model, like GPT-4 Vision, and get more richer look at what's in the image. So if it's like a graph, you can first filter out that, okay, there's a graph in this image, and then you can customize the question you're asking GPT-4 Turbo about that image. So there's a lot of these tricks that go into making a useful product. And anyone who has a curiosity to play with these things, and anyone who has the passion to talk to users and solve their problems will end up building something that is used by a lot of people. In terms of tech history, I think a lot about, you know, OpenAI. Their story is so interesting, right? They started in 2015 when Google had the world's best researchers. They had billions and billions of dollars. Hundreds of billions of dollars. They had the world's data. Like, you know, there's a billion queries plus happening a day on Google. There's YouTube video data, audio data, text data. They have the most data in the world. And they have the best researchers. They have the most money. Not just that, they have their customized hardware, right? They have custom hardware to train these AI models, not TPUs. They didn't have that in 2015, but, you know, the project was already underway.
They should have won on paper. Like, they should have. Every AI company that was started, like every transformational tech that's come out in AI in the last decade, like Google basically invented all of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Google invented all of it. And they should have won on paper. And yet today we have OpenAI and ChatGPT just like crushing it. Even though, and Google has distribution. They had distribution through search and YouTube and Android and Maps and Google Images. Like, they just have everything. And yet they're not able to catch up or keep up. So, you know, with technology, like, things move really fast. And there's ways in which startups can build things, talk to users, keep their ears close to the ground, and innovate and build really cool things. Another example of this is NVIDIA. And I think that might answer Asha's question of, like, what happens to these AI startups? There's so many, it might take a whole podcast to list them all. But when NVIDIA started, 1993, you know, this was the year when I believe Doom and Quake came out. And everyone had the insight that consumer gaming is going to be really big. Because for the first time, you can play 3D games on a PC. And 3D is just like amazing. You have a whole world on your computer that you can explore and like build Minecraft or whatever. 3D is just so powerful, right? And not just Jensen and the two other co-founders of NVIDIA had the same idea. So did 89 other companies who started in 1993 doing the exact same thing, which is to build a graphics card that would help you play video games on your PC.
So why'd they win?
A big part of why they won was persistence and not dying and always thinking on your feet. So they were prescient enough in 1993 to realize that, wait, we have 18 other companies doing the exact same thing. We need to get the next generation of chip out first before everyone else does, because within months, everyone else is going to catch up anyway. And that was their strategy for many years, where they just kept getting the next generation of graphics card out first before the competition could. And, you know, Microsoft tried to kill them with Direct3D. Intel tried to kill them by integrating graphics card into motherboards. They said, how about we just give you a motherboard that already has a CPU and a graphics card? And then NVIDIA realizes that, wait, if we call our thing a graphics card, people are just going to buy this thing from Intel. And they completely rebrand to GPUs, which is like a whole new thing.
Instead of a graphics card, it's a processing unit.
Exactly. And there's like a lot of like early history about this, about how like GPUs for the first few months were a marketing term. They weren't truly programmable, but they realized that, hey, if we call our thing a GPU, it's like a whole new thing, right? It's not the graphics card that you already get with your Intel motherboard. You need a GPU to play video games. And then about a decade in is when, you know, scientific computing became really obvious. But it wasn't until 2004, 2005, 10, 12 years in, when most of the startups out of those 89 companies died. They just didn't stick around long enough. So persistence is a big part of it. Understanding where your industry is moving, what's the competitive advantage, what do the users want? The users want the fastest chip out first, even if it is really buggy, turns out that's what gamers wanted in the 90s. It wasn't the cheapest. It wasn't the most reliable. It was that they just wanted the next chip the fastest. So you have to understand your space.
Yeah, that's kind of the takeaway. It's just, what is the thing that your customers actually want? And just do that. Sounds easy enough.
I feel like startups are a really simple algorithm. Like, there aren't like many 4D chess ideas. The algorithm is really simple. It's just hard to execute and continue to execute the algorithm.
So then how do you think about just, I guess we'll call it building a moat, like if that's fair to say, and where do you get some of that inspiration from just throughout history or other startups?
Totally. I think startups by default don't have a moat. When you first start, you sort of have to carve your moat out of things. And each startup has, you know, its own unique moat. Startups in a way are like all startups are outliers. And you can't take NVIDIA's playbook and execute that playbook, you know, exactly how they did it and end up with the same outcome, because NVIDIA is a very unique company. Right? Startups are all about power laws. It's the outliers that win. With Airbnb, for example, Airbnb and Couchsurfing.com were just pretty much the same idea. Right? Couchsurfing was venture funded. Airbnb was venture funded. Couchsurfing had more distribution, but Airbnb just focused on different things. Like, what if the houses that are on Airbnb, they just had really nice photos? And what if we took the houses that are on Airbnb and cross-posted those listings, and they automated that apparently in the early days, and that, you know, skyrocketed the growth even though they had no distribution.
So do you have any things like that with Julius? Like, these are the couple things that we just opinionated product differences.
So we try to use a lot of different models for their strengths. So we have a feature where oftentimes the user will ask the AI to generate a data visualization, and that data visualization is not what they actually wanted. You know, maybe the color is different than what they wanted. And either they can just like chat and give the model a feedback, or what we actually do is we take the image and we take the code that generated that image, pass it through a different model, get that model to give us parameters and toggles to change that graph. So that attention to detail of what the users are trying to do and how do we let them do that in a very easy way is by using the best models out there is going to be, I think, really useful, at least in the next few years. And the hope is that if we continue building what the users want, we'll have a good business.
So do you have other AI companies that you feel like are doing a really good job of this, or any that you really look up to?
Totally. There's Pika Labs that is doing text to video. And with AI, they're building something that is really cool and useful to a lot of people. Another company that comes to my mind is Midjourney. They're a really unique company in the sense that it's just a Discord channel or a Discord server. They have no generally available UI even till today. When they first launched, they used publicly available models and used that data and feedback to train better models. And they focused on one thing and one thing only, which is, what if you made it really easy to make art using AI? And that sounds really simple, but in practice is really hard to do. But, you know, I have my friend Kyle, his mom, she's like 50 years old. She's never been on Discord, but she's on the Midjourney Discord server trying to generate art that she can use in her recipe blog because she just wants to make this blog. And when she's talking about pasta, she wants to show Italy and, like, you know, somebody cooking pasta in Italy with like the Colosseum in the background, the Leaning Tower of Pisa in the background. And you can just take your imagination and turn it into art. And turns out there's massive demand for that. So I think those are two really cool companies.
I always think it's crazy that they've got, like, I don't know what the latest public number is. I think the highest public number I saw was like 400 million in revenue or something. But whatever the number is, an astronomical amount. And it's literally just people typing in text to make art. And it's all in Discord too. That's the most insane part to me. Like, who knew you could make a mid to high nine-figure revenue business on Discord? like insane.
It's crazy because no market map could have predicted it.
Yeah, exactly.
No Substack could have predicted it.
Yeah. Well, the thing I think is amazing about Discord is like they were the center of crypto when like Web3 was a thing. Like everyone was on Discord. And then now with AI, it's like all these AI companies have Discords and like some of them are built on Discord. Their business model is processing the whole business and like processing the images and everything on Discord. It's crazy.
Yeah, 100%. With Julius, we're focusing a ton on what do the users want. And as long as you build what the users want and what these models are capable of, I think we will have a great product that will serve millions of users. I'll use a couple of examples. So today, when you generate a data visualization on Julius, we use a different model than the model we use for code generation to, you know, change the graphs and give you toggles to play around with different parameters on the graph. It's hard to do that with natural language. So we, on the fly, generate UI components that we can surface to the user that they can play with and then change the graph with. Not just that, there's another example is computers, right? We're giving these models really powerful computers and code environments where they can write code and do useful things. Building and maintaining these computers is hard because, you know, these models have a certain amount of knowledge in their training data. They remember certain modules and code packages that up to a certain date, and making sure that your environments are compatible with that. And the model, what the model expects is what you actually have in your computer for the model is hard. And we're hyper focused on building that infrastructure of computers, maintaining those and making those very easy to use for the AI.
So it's basically that the whole product is almost AI native, if that makes sense.
It's completely AI native.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of sounds like a pie in the sky, like description, but I guess it's kind of true. It sounds like your UI that you present to the user actually changes based on what they want to do with it.
Exactly. So we generate UI components, but we let the models decide what UI components to surface to you based on what you're trying to do. So when you open a tool like Excel, you see all the controls at once. And that gets super intimidating. It's really hard to use. In Julius, the main component is your chat box with the AI. And then the AI can populate more and more, you know, UI components on the fly to do what you want to do.
Fascinating. So I have two other questions. I feel like this is a question from someone else because I don't know why I would ask this, but it's on my list. I can't remember who gave me this one. So you Lyft, why? You could argue it's a distraction from building.
Who asked that? That's so funny.
I didn't make a note of who told me that one, but it's an interesting one. Oh, you know what it is? It's because I think I added it because we're friends on Be Real and you should always like post your Be Reals from the gym and you'd be like working out. So obviously like it's a big thing.
Yeah. I love Be Real. I think working out lifting is fun because, you know, it just helps clear your mind. It helps you get physically tired at the end of the day. So that when you have a lot of going on in your head, like all these, you know, possible paths that you're exploring about where Julius could go, like where are the things we could do, it sort of like helps you shut that off and just fall asleep for 6 hours or 5 hours or whatever amount of sleep you're trying to get at the night. On a more philosophical level, it also shows you like how progressive overload is. It applies to so many things in life. Right? When you first go to the gym, you try to lift like, you know, less than a plate and you really struggle. But then you do that over time and you get to a point where you start warming up with the weight that you used to max out at a few months ago, a few years ago. So it's very philosophical too in a way.
Yeah, I felt like I got a lot of benefits. Like when I really started working out consistently in college, I just noticed like I was just like better at everything else. Like you're just, your blood moves faster, your reactions are better, you're more confident. Like you're just better at everything that you do, basically. I mean, that's how I would describe it to people. And it's healthy, right? Like, do you want to be out of shape or in shape? Do you want to like, you know, you probably like live longer or whatever. Like it's healthy, it's good.
Totally.
And then, I mean, could you argue that it like distracts you from making progress on your startup, or it's like a worthy trade-off?
I think B-roll is a bigger distraction than lifting.
The 1 second on that you post. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then this is another question from Ashe. Assuming there's a story behind this, but what do you love about SF and what do you hate about SF?
I love SF. I don't think where I am today, it would be possible if I wasn't in the US or I wasn't in SF. So I'm grateful for both of those things. With SF, I think there's this community of people who are very high agency and open-minded and always wanting to try new ideas and trying to be at the edge of cool things. You know, you see a Waymo driving around and then you go to a party on a Friday and there's a Waymo engineer who helps build Waymo at the party.
And Waymo is Google's self-driving car, just for people completely out of the loop. And they work, by the way. They're real. They're really cool to ride in.
They're really cool. Yeah, they're really cool to ride in. They work. You see, if you go on like a 30-minute walk around San Francisco, as of April 11, 2024, you will see at least 5 Waymos in the 30-minute walk. So I love that about San Francisco. And it's hard to find a lot of high agency people like that anywhere else. But the downside of it is there's also low variance of people. So, you know, you go to a coffee shop, people are talking about, you know, startups or AI. Or you go to the gym, everyone around you is like a tech worker. And sometimes I miss the like low variance of like a high variance of people, where someone's training for a marathon or someone's writing a book. So I think there's pros and cons to SF.
It's the beauty that I get living in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hell yeah.
So Rahul, last question. I know you take a lot of inspiration from history, other companies, other founders. Do you have a favorite one, favorite story?
Totally. I think it's really important to read about the non-PR stories of startups to know what actually went, what they went through and what happened. Not the eBay story of, hey, I wanted to sell Pez dispensers and I started eBay. Turns out Pierre just built this site auction web and just posted a bunch of links on online forums until he got users. But my favorite one is, I think, Microsoft, because of how dominant they were at some point in time in history and how they basically invented and controlled the software industry out of like no existing moat. You know, I have a bunch of like Microsoft posters in my room. These are like actual ad posters from when they first started Microsoft. So this one is a Microsoft Basic. For the first 7 years, Microsoft was in the business of programming languages.
So they created programming languages?
Not really. They took programming languages that already existed and these computer makers like Altair and Macintosh and IBM, all these computer makers wanted these programming languages to work on their hardware, depending on what chip they have or what processor they have. Because if these languages work, then developers can build applications that actually make this hardware useful, right? If you're a computer maker, you make the computer hardware, but if no one actually makes something that works on it, then no one will buy the computer outside of a hobbyist. So Microsoft would, you know, sell licenses of like BASIC, Fortran to Altair, Commodore, IBM, Mac, Apple. And that was their bread and butter for the first 5 or 6 years. This is before, you know, operating system is what they really became known for, but that didn't exist. You know, they were in the business of programming languages. In fact, CPM is an operating system that we've never heard of today, but that used to be the dominant operating system in the 70s. Everyone had CPM until Microsoft, you know, bought DOS from a different company and then made it work on the IBM PC, and the rest is history. So what's interesting is that like they went through so many iterations to get turned into a $1 trillion company, become really, really dominant in a market that before the 70s didn't exist. There was no software market. The TAM for software was zero before the 70s.
Yeah, all those VCs would have passed. The TAM wasn't big enough.
It's just true. You know, like Bill Gates was, he built Microsoft Bootstrap. It took no outside capital until, I believe, the year before they went public.
And it was basically, he just wanted kind of a board member and just someone who could, you know, be an adult in the room, I think is maybe like a way to describe it. Just like, we're going public. Like, I probably need some help with this.
That's funny. Yeah. So he's just, I want to go public. I'm ready. I just need an adult in the room. It's crazy. You know, I talked a lot about Excel just now, but there's this thing Microsoft built before Excel. It was called Multiplan, which I have a poster for. This is the Multiplan ad poster from the 80s. But this was Microsoft's spreadsheet software before they built Excel. And they were trying to compete with Lotus 1-2-3 and VisiCalc, and Multiplan went nowhere. And then today, Excel is basically on every single PC out there. Any kind of desk job you do, you probably work with Excel.
Yeah, Excel like runs the economy, really.
Right, right, exactly. And it took them, you know, 1987 to get the first Excel out, 12 years into the company. So that to me is like a really interesting company, because they built a really successful product, a series of really successful products that didn't immediately work out of the box, but ended up being used by billions of people, and they invented a market out of it.
Yeah, it's a lot of good inspiration for founders. Never give up. Stick with it. It might take you 12 years to figure something out. And then now it's a $1 trillion company. Well, this is awesome. Thanks for coming on. This is a really fun conversation.
Thanks, Turner. This was great chatting.
And thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, share this episode with a friend who's building something in AI. If you don't want to miss future episodes, subscribe to my newsletter in the show notes, and you'll get new ones plus the transcripts in your inbox every week. Thanks again to Rahul for coming on, and to Roon, Guillermo, Mike, Akshay, Terrence, Sandy, and Ashay for the topic discussions. Thanks for listening. See you next time.